Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We're live worldwide on Close Up Radio, which is a service of the award-winning Close Up Television Radio. This is your host, Jim Masters. It's 10 a.m. Eastern here at the Broadcast Center, April 5th, 2022. And thank you very much for joining us from all around the world. We appreciate you making us a part of your day. We're also continuing our exclusive close-up radio series. This is part two of our two-part series with Dr. Philip J. Cross of Kenyon Consulting, the founder of Kenyon Consulting, and where he provides economic and statistical consulting services to law firms, businesses, nonprofits, and government agencies. Dr. Cross specializes in economic tricks. I knew I was going to have trouble with this word today. It's been a long day. Economic tricks, we'll have him say it, which combines statistical analysis with economic theory to draw inferences about economic outcomes. And Dr. Cross has worked on a wide range of litigation matters, both on the plaintiff side and the defense side as well. And unlike the economists one might see on cable news, who are typically macroeconomists, Dr. Cross is a microeconomist. We're going to talk about what that really is. He doesn't study the economics of large entities like countries, but rather the economics of small entities like workers or customers or firms. Again, the company is Kenyon Consulting. In a wrongful termination lawsuit, for instance, Dr. Cross's job is to calculate how the worker's future wages are impacted by the alleged wrongful termination. Originally from Australia, Dr. Cross has spent 20 years as an economist in academia, government, and consulting. Prior to launching Kenyon Consulting, Dr. Cross taught in the economics department at Georgetown University. He says some of the analysis that he does can be a little bit high-tech, but one of the skills of being an expert witness is breaking down technical concept in a way that lay audience can really understand. So when he testifies in front of a judge or jury, he draws on that experience teaching college students, finding the right level of detail to explain what he's saying in a way for all to understand. Let's welcome him back to Close Up Radio for part two of the series today. Dr. Cross, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim. It's nice to talk to you this morning. And the pronunciation is econometrics. So there we go.
That's what we thought. Need an extra cup of coffee today, I think, as well.
So let me just start by explaining what this somewhat technical term econometrics means. So econometrics is basically statistics as it is applied to economic outcomes. So you wouldn't be that far wrong if you described my profession as being a statistician as opposed to an economist. I do a lot of statistics. I crunch a lot of numbers. I just typically do that in the context of statistics as they apply to economic outcomes, like, for example, the wages that someone might be expected to earn. And so statistics as it's applied to economic outcomes is called econometrics. So that's what that somewhat fancy term means.
Let's talk about how it actually applies. Like I mentioned earlier, you have a way, a knack for presenting things to the layperson so it's easily digestible and people can really see the application of it in their lives. How does it apply? Like, give us some great examples of where it actually comes into play for you.
Okay. So you mentioned in your quite nice introduction about a wrongful termination suit. So wrongful termination litigation cases involve a plaintiff who is alleging that he or she has been wrongfully terminated from their job. And in a case like that, the plaintiff will typically retain a law firm, and the law firm might retain an economic expert like myself to opine about what's called lost wages. So that's the difference between the wages that this person is expected to earn, given that they've been terminated from their job, comparing that with what they would have been expected to earn had they not been wrongfully terminated from their job and had have continued on a different career path. And so you compute these two numbers. One is the wages you would earn in what's called what we call the real world, the actual world for this particular individual moving forward, and then we compare that to the wages that they would earn in the what's called the but-for world. So this term but-for arises a lot in the type of work that I do, and it just means but for the alleged bad behavior by an employer, for example, by wrongfully terminating this particular employee, what would this person's wages have been moving forward? So on a case like that, I need to do an economic analysis where I'm forecasting out two different sets of wages. Okay, and I take into consideration this person's work history and this person's expected wage stream moving forward, which is related to work history, but also related to their level of education, and then other outside options they might have for earning income. So that's where my skills as an economist come in, and then my skills as a statistician or a number cruncher come in the forecasting part of it, because I have to forecast through, take someone who is, for example, 35 years old and they've been allegedly wrongfully terminated. I'm going to have to forecast 30 years of income stream for that person through to their expected retirement age of, for example, 65. So that's where the econometrics part of things come in. And by the way, I was just describing a situation where I might be the economic expert retained by the plaintiff in a wrongful termination suit. It's important to know that I'm the type of expert that works both on the plaintiff side and on the defence side of court cases, so I could certainly be involved for the defence in a wrongful termination suit as well, where I'm trying to make an argument that perhaps the opposing side, the plaintiff side, is forecasting a level of lost wages that's perhaps so high as to be not credible, and I might be opining about what a more credible number is for those lost wages if I'm retained by a law firm who's working for the defence.
That's really fascinating. What are some other applications too? That was a great example.
Okay. So I've worked on healthcare cases where rather than taking someone's history of earning wage income and trying to forecast out what's expected to happen, I've worked on healthcare cases where, for example, the relevance amount that I'm trying to forecast or estimate has to do with the expected charge that a healthcare provider, like a doctor, might make to a health insurer. So kind of broadly similar type of analysis in that there's lots of statistics and lots of number crunching. But in this second example that I'm talking about here, we're not talking about number crunching involving income streams. We're talking about number crunching involving the amount of reimbursement a doctor, for example, will be asking a health insurer for if they treat one of that health insurer's insurees as a patient, for example, in a emergency room. And then let's see, other examples. I sometimes work on antitrust cases, so where there's an alleged cartel that's been created that has allegedly raised prices. And so again, broad picture, I'm going to do some number crunching and I'm going to try to make a statement that says, okay, if these two or three firms have gotten together, the result of them colluding is that they're charging folks higher prices than would have been than they would have been charging had they, rather than colluding, had been competing with each other. And so, again, this is a situation where you are interested in forecasting two different streams. In this case, it's a stream of prices. The actual prices that might apply if a bunch of firms are colluding together and there's an allegation that that collusion is illegal versus, I'm going to use this term, but-for again, the but-for prices. So these are the prices that these firms would have charged for their products but for the alleged illegal collusion. And so, again, it's a number-crunching exercise where I'm trying to take two streams of prices and compare how, for example, consumers might be harmed because the prices that the consumers face under collusion might be forecasting out to be higher than the prices forecast out if these firms, but for the collusion, were just competing in a regular way and presumably be charging lower prices. So lots of the types of analysis that I can do in my expert witness work have to do with forecasting out these two different streams. One stream of things that happen in the real world when some allegedly illegal behavior has happened, and I would compare that stream of prices or wages or whatever it might be to the other stream that happens in the but-for world. And again, that term but-for means, but for the alleged illegal behavior, what would we have expected the prices of these products to be from these firms who have been accused of colluding? Or what would we have expected the wages to be of this individual, but for the fact that they were wrongfully terminated from their job? And so I take these two different streams of prices or incomes or other economic variables that we might be interested in. One stream that actually occurs under the condition of alleged bad behaviour or alleged illegal behaviour, and the other stream which would occur absent the alleged illegal behaviour, and I can compare the two, and that's a way to kind of quantify monetary damages that have resulted to a particular individual or a particular set of customers because of this alleged legal behaviour.
I mentioned in the introduction, and I think it's fascinating to really point out the differences too, because our listeners might not realize the difference. You know, there are those out there, economists that you might see on cable television, who are typically macro economists, and you're a micro economist. So what's really interesting about this is it's grounded in facts. There are the economic experts who, you know, sometimes may manipulate the data to give the client the number that they want, but that's not how you operate. Tell us about that.
Yes, so it's important in the economics profession to distinguish between macroeconomics and microeconomics, and you're quite correct. The sort of work I do falls into the latter category of microeconomics. So the difference between the two is that macroeconomics is the economics of big things, like the gross domestic product of a country or the inflation rate of a country. So it's stuff involving big entities, whereas microeconomics is about what's going on economically with smaller entities, like, for example, a group of workers or even just one worker, or a group of customers, consumers of a particular product, or a group of firms that are supplying a particular product. And one of the differences between microeconomics and macroeconomics is I've already talked a little bit about forecasting, which is important both in microeconomics and macroeconomics. But in microeconomics, which is what I do, forecasting, fortunately for me, tends to be much more grounded in facts, because you can build a sensible forecast based on data that's available, for example, of the recent work history of someone, seeing what their wages have recently been, is a useful way to form a forecast of what we might expect their wages to be in the future. Now, in contrast, macroeconomics, the economics of big things, like the growth rates of countries, for example, macroeconomics forecasting is also very important in macroeconomics, but unfortunately, a lot of the forecasting in macroeconomics goes on kind of in an absence of data to help you come up with a sensible forecast. And you were kind of mentioning before, a lot of the economist talking heads that you might see on cable TV might be these type of macroeconomic forecasters who are going to tell you what they think is going to happen to the US inflation rate, for example, 2 years from now. And they might have a gut feeling of what that's supposed to be, but they don't really have much beyond a gut feeling to drive what their forecast is going to be. And I might compare some of these macroeconomic forecasters who are really not doing stuff that's particularly grounded in science. You could compare some of these macroeconomic forecasters to a weather forecaster. Okay, now weather forecasting is very useful, and it also can be very accurate if you're forecasting out what's going to happen 24 hours from now or 48 hours from now. But if a weather forecaster told you that 2 months from now they expect the maximum temperature in a particular town to be 65 degrees, that's kind of a ridiculous forecast to make. To go that far out and to have that precise a forecast about what the maximum temperature is going to be is not something that any credible weather forecaster is going to be able to sensibly do. And a lot of these macroeconomic forecasters kind of do the same, a similar sort of thing where they're looking way out into the future and they're giving very accurate forecasts of what they expect to happen, but they're not really grounded in anything that kind of justifies having that accuracy. So that's macroeconomic forecasting, whereas what I do as a microeconomist is I'm interested in microeconomic forecasting, which is much more grounded in science and in data that you can analyze to come up with sensible, credible, and defensible forecasts.
That's really fascinating. Thanks for taking time to break that out, because I sometimes, you know, people don't realize the uniqueness of the work and the differences as well. You know, I'm fascinated, and you've done on the previous episode and this episode, share with us some nice examples, some really solid examples of the expert witness work you do. What are some other examples where that work comes into play for you, other types of cases and work that you have an opportunity to immerse yourself in?
Okay. So, yes, thanks for asking that question. I can talk about some of that stuff. So I should start by saying that maybe three-quarters of the work that I do is expert witness work, where I'm retained by a law firm to offer an opinion about either for the plaintiff or for the defense for a particular civil suit. Actually, I also very occasionally work on criminal law matters, but not so often. Mostly it's civil lawsuits that I'm retained to offer an economic opinion about. So that's maybe three-quarters of the work that I do, but I do occasionally do some other types of work. So I've done, for example, some government work. Again, it involves forecasting, but forecasting for governments that isn't tied to any particular legal litigation or anything like that. So I can talk a little bit about one example where a few years ago I was working for a Western European government, and in this particular country, unlike in the United States, student loans, so funding of higher education, is run through a government-run student loan program. And this particular government was interested in default rates. So a bunch of students and potential students are going to get these government loans, and they're going to go to university, or they're going to go to college, and then maybe they'll graduate or maybe they won't, but they're going to accumulate debts to the government through this student loan program. And a certain fraction of these students are going to repay their debts, but then a certain fraction are going to end up defaulting on their debts. And the way this student loan program works in this particular country where I was working on this matter is that the repayment rates that the students have to make on their student loans is a function of how much income they earn. So if I'm trying to forecast out whether people are going to repay their student loans, That's tied to me forecasting out what I expect people's incomes to be moving forward. Because if they have higher incomes moving forward, the way the rules of this student loan repayment work is you're going to make higher repayments based on earning higher incomes in the future. And then the people who are likely to default on their loans are people who end up with lower or maybe even very low future income, for which the student loan repayment rules mean you're paying back very little of the loan amount that you owe the government, and possibly you're paying back nothing at all. So again, this is an exercise in forecasting, and it involves taking a bunch of people who either graduated from a college or a university or a community college or something like that with a particular degree, and it also involves some people who took out student loans who didn't end up graduating. That also happens. And trying to forecast out for these different types of people what I expect their future incomes to be, and then on the basis of that, I can come up with a credible forecast of which of these students are going to be repaying their student loans and which of these students are going to be defaulting and not repaying their student loans. So again, kind of the analysis, the number crunching involved is quite similar to these other things that we've been talking about earlier. That involve litigation matters, but this particular thing that I'm talking about here had nothing to do with litigation. It's just that this particular Western European government just wanted to get a handle of how many of these loans that they've made they expected to go bad and not be repaid. And so that was a very interesting piece of analysis that I did a few years back.
You also use some really deep technical expertise in economics and statistics and data science to yield the optimal solutions for your clients. And you really present it all in plain English for judges, juries, and clients to easily digest, which I think is what makes this so relatable for the clients as well. And you have this acute understanding of economic theory and statistical techniques and data collection, which really helps to generate the clear insights assisting governments and businesses in litigation and non-litigation contexts, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in part of your very kind introduction to me, you mentioned that I used to be an academic. I used to teach in the economics department of Georgetown University. And so back in those days, getting up in front of a bunch of undergraduates and trying to teach concepts about economics or econometrics or statistics that sometimes, you know, are quite technical in nature, trying to convey what you're trying to convey to a group of undergraduates, some of which might have a little bit of a natural aptitude for kind of absorbing these technical concepts, but then some other members of the class might struggle a little bit with some of these technical concepts. And so as a lecturing to a group of undergraduates, as you do when you're a university professor, involves a lot of trying to pitch what you're trying to get across. The technical aspects of what you're trying to get across have to be pitched at a level that the bulk, if not all, of your audience can absorb. So I did that for a number of years. I find that the experience that I developed from lecturing undergraduate kids when I was at Georgetown helps a lot in my current job, where I'm operating as an expert witness and I'm testifying in front of a judge or in front of a panel of judges or in front of a jury. And again, I might be trying to convey certain technical, economic, and statistical ideas, but I'm trying to relay them to someone who, unlike me, doesn't have a PhD in economics, and they're just like a layperson when it comes to these types of ideas, and kind of pitching it at the right level so you can get across the point you're trying to get across, but in a way that doesn't lose people. It's a skill, and I work at it every day, but I feel like my experience of having previously been a teacher at Georgetown University has really helped with me honing that skill.
What are some of the things you enjoy most about the work, too? Because I guess, you know, it can really be quite intense. You're really getting into the nitty-gritty of a lot of these the cases and the scenarios. What are some of the things, you know, why does it give you great blessing and joy to do this work, knowing, I would imagine, that, you know, that you're finding the truth, there's justice, fairness, and you're helping people who sometimes, you know, when they come to you, they're frustrated, they're confused, you know, and they don't feel like they're making any progress in certain areas. And you come in and you're able to sort of break it all down and deduce and investigate and dig deep. What are some of the blessings and joys for you personally as a result of really doing this work as expertly and for as long as you've been doing it, Doctor?
All right, that's a great question. One of the things I really enjoy in my job when I can pull it off is I've kind of alluded a few times already in the past 20 minutes or so to the fact that I kind of pride myself in the scientific integrity of the expert opinions that I can provide in a particular litigation matter. And one thing that I should mention without naming names is that some economic experts don't operate with that same focus on scientific integrity. So, you know, if a law firm wants to retain an economic expert who are really malleable to kind of saying whatever the law firm would like them to say, as opposed to doing a completely independent and scientifically based analysis and just coming up with a result that's founded in science, there are experts out there who do operate that way. So one of the most enjoyable things for me, as since I don't operate that way, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I operated that way. I have to complete my work with a level of integrity that makes me comfortable. One of the things that I really enjoy is when I'm coming up in a particular litigation matter against an opposing expert who is one of these types of experts who really isn't putting a ton of scientific integrity into his work. But as I mentioned before, often the concepts that we're talking about can be quite technical. And so I'm sitting on one side of a litigation matter. The opposing economic expert is doing what I would consider a poor analysis, one that's not unbiased and founded in facts and has very little scientific integrity. So it's my job to convince the court that this is the problem with the opposing economic expert and that what I'm doing, in contrast, does have scientific integrity. And as I said before, you know, often there's technical concepts involved where it's kind of hard to get across to a jury or to a judge exactly what's going on. But sometimes I do manage to get across to the judge or the jury these technical concepts that I'm arguing about with this opposing expert. You know, I'm the one who's doing the good faith, scientifically backed research, whereas the opposing expert is what's called in the industry a hired gun, who's just basically saying the number that the lawyers that he's working for would like him to say without a ton of science backing it up. So you're asking, one of the things that I enjoy the most is I always enjoy kind of providing good economic analysis for clients, but I particularly enjoy it when I'm providing good scientifically based economic analysis for clients where the opposing economic expert is not doing that. And I end up convincing the court that I'm the one who's doing things the right way and the opposing expert is the one who's not doing things the right way.
Really fascinating. Thanks for breaking that out for us and really letting us know why you do what you do so well and why you love it so much. I encourage folks to go to the website, www.kenyon-consulting.com. And Kenyon is spelled K-E-N-Y-O-N. So that's Kenyon-consulting.com to connect with our very special guest, Dr. Philip J. Cross of Kenyon Consulting. Dr. Cross, thanks so much for joining us here on the show. Truly a pleasure, and we learned a lot, and we appreciate all the incredible work that you do and hope we have an opportunity to explore some more down the line. That would also be a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, that's great. It was a pleasure for me too, Jim. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. And we thank our audience as well, listening from all around the world. This is your host, Jim Masters. Thank you on this time, next time. And stay tuned. We'll be back momentarily with another fascinating guest right here on Close Up Radio. Until then, for all of us, have a great day, and thanks for being with us. Bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.